where we explore people, events, and stories of the seven counties of the KHOI listening area in the heart of Iowa. I am one of your hosts for this hour, Cornelia Flora, and the other is
Gina McAndrews.
Thank you for listening in. I hope you stay with us for the hour. We're going to talk about women in agriculture, particularly women in agriculture in the heart of Iowa. But we're also going to compare it how changes have occurred historically and what is going on in some other countries as well. Our first guest to start this is Angie Carter. She's a wonderful person to start the conversation with. She's conducted major research about women in agriculture in Iowa and has interviewed many women across the state as they work to make agriculture more resilient to the changing policies and weather we're all facing. She has conducted major research about women in agriculture in Iowa, and she's hometown girl, so to speak, to Ames. She got her PhD in sociology and sustainable agriculture with us at Iowa State. And currently, she lives in Michigan, where she is assistant professor of environmental and energy justice in the Department of Social Sciences at Michigan Technological University in Houghton, Michigan. Angie is joining us by phone from Michigan. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Cornelia.
Angie, you have done research for quite a while on women in agriculture around the world, but especially in Iowa. What can you tell us about what exciting things women are doing in agriculture these days in our state?
Yes, so there's a lot of excellent work underway by many organizations in the state of Iowa to try to make our agricultural system more sustainable and resilient and to support rural well-being and livelihood in our rural communities. I've been collaborating with the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network since I started in my graduate program at Iowa State in 2010, and I'm now a board member of that organization. And through Women, Food, and Agriculture Network, I realized that there was a lot of unseen work being done with women farmland owners and farmers in Iowa, and it was leading to really important changes. I wanted to be able to help elevate the work that Women, Food, and Ag Network was doing, some really groundbreaking work that Betty Wells at Iowa State, you and Jean Eels, who's an ag education PhD graduate from Iowa State who partners with Women, Food, and Ag Network too, and others were doing to study what communities of women are doing to transform the landscape. And so I did interviews across the state of Iowa, learning circles across the state of Iowa with women to talk about water quality, starting in about 2012. And as you know, this is a very hot topic in Iowa. There's a lot of concern about what we're doing or what we're not doing in our watersheds to try to improve water quality. And I found that women farmland owners have a lot of interest in future visions for their farmland that they may have trouble realizing because we're not reaching them with our ag extension and education, or we're not reaching them with our agricultural programs, that often they might be limited in what they can do on their farmland because they rely upon other family members or their farm tenants or others for information, and really feel like they don't have a lot of choice in what they're doing on their land. But legally, what they do on their land is their decision. And it's really important that we're reaching them with messages about conservation and about what change is possible there, because they're very, very important. They own half the farmland in Iowa, so it's really important that we're reaching them with these messages.
This is really exciting because women have always been in agriculture. In fact, some of the first people to do agriculture were women. Women often do the seed selection. While their husbands might plant, they definitely would do much of the harvesting. In the Midwest, we've had women, the division of labor generally has been that women have done the garden and the chickens, and if you had just a couple cows for milking, then that would be women's work. In other words, production for the household was women's work. And as soon as you made money from it, it became men's work. I've seen this in Africa where women haul the water and gather the wood, except when you do it for sale, and suddenly that's men's work. So it's the value chain sometimes that has determined in the past who is attributed to being a farmer. But another thing we found in our studies of settlements in Kansas was that the homes that survived from generation to generation were the ones that had several daughters. And that's because the women's work in the barn, in the house, in the garden, with the chickens and the cows, were what allowed that farm to keep going. So this importance of what women are doing on the land and the fact that they are gaining a voice in saying what should happen on it, I think is very exciting.
Yeah, it's really important what you've shared about how women have always been very involved in agriculture. Yesterday was the International Day of Rural Women, declared by the United Nations. And I wrote a blog with my fellow student colleague from Iowa State, who now works at Pesticide Action Network over in the Bay Area, Anna Kruzik, about the International Day of Rural Women and how important it is that we're recognizing the needed and essential work that women are doing in our food system and on our farms. So some statistics I have from that blog handy are that over half of our restaurant workers are women, 36% of farmers are women in the United States today. And we may not always talk about our women farmers or women landowners, but we sure often don't see people talking about our women restaurant workers and others working in the food system and processing and food production. And so women are essential to our food system, and ensuring that they have access to needed information and that they are working in safe and respectful work environments is important for anyone who cares about gender equity, but also anyone who cares about our food system, because they are the essential part of it.
And we just had the big seed conference here in Ames, Iowa, with Iowa State University, and Cornelia and I were there, and it was interesting fact that there was a large portion of the seed curators and people leading in the seed industry have been women that they had at the conference.
Yes, the importance of genetic diversity and who saves the seeds is also, I think, of increasing concern as we say, how are we going to make sure our seeds can adapt to more heat, more cold, more rain, less water, too much water. And a lot of the traditional varieties had a lot of, we call them survival skills, that we may need to go into as we, science works with local people to try to make sure that we have a healthy, diverse food system where those who produce, process, transport, serve the food are respected and can make a living at it.
Yeah, what you shared, Gina and Cornelia, is so important. I think people might take for granted, go to the store, you buy a pack of seeds to plant in your garden, that the majority of those seeds are being controlled by a few transnational corporations. And what does that mean for the health of our food system? What does that mean for the health of our bodies? We're really lucky that we have those who have been working in seed keeping for a long time that we can learn from in Iowa. Seed Savers in Decorah is such a wonderful place. So much knowledge from around the world, right, held there. About the importance of these seeds, what types of varieties for different climates in this. We're also really lucky to have seed keepers such as Rowan White, Mohawk seed keeper Rowan White, and others, the indigenous seed keepers, that I think we may not learn as much about as might be helpful to at our land-grant universities, but we definitely should be teaching about the importance of indigenous seed keeping, because we're so lucky to still have the original caretakers of many of these seeds still doing work and farming in these landscapes. And it's important that we learn from them. The Red Earth Seed, the Red Earth Gardens down at Meskwaki is doing really important food sovereignty work. If people know where their casino is, there on Highway 30, right behind it, their organic farm, all the work they're doing to bring seeds back and rebuild knowledge about seed keeping in their community is just transformational.
That is a very interesting area, and it is so close to us here in the heart of Iowa. We worked for quite a while in Ecuador, and one of our colleagues, an indigenous woman from Ecuador, came to visit. And we took her there, and she had brought some seeds from Cotacachi that she gave to them, and they gave her some of their seeds. And this notion of seed exchange, and one of the things we're learning is that the majority of people get their seed around the world by saving it or exchanging it among friends and relatives. And we don't do that anymore. We have a lot of monocultures, and we depend on seed breeders that tend to be multinational corporations. And unfortunately, for that reason, GMOs, genetically modified organisms, got a very bad reputation based on the fact that the first way they were genetically modified was to withstand, be resistant to certain chemicals, certain herbicides. So that meant you used more herbicides because you had more weeds as you planted things close together. Thus, we saw that there was a lot of residual pesticide on some food, although people worked very hard to deny that. Thus, people dismiss all genetic modification because of this initial introduction, basically to make a profit rather than to see the various ways that genetic modification can be used to breed drought resistance, to breed other characteristics.
What are some of the activities you're working on up in Michigan, Angie?
Yeah, thanks, Gina, for that question. So I'm still very lucky to be involved with the Women Food and Agriculture Network. I serve on their board. And so this weekend I'm going to the National Women in Sustainable Agriculture Conference in St. Paul. So that's just up the road from folks there if they're interested. Moses Organic Organization in Wisconsin, Women Food and Ag Network, and some other organizations are collaborating on that conference this year. And I'm still doing some research in Iowa with Women Food and Ag Network about women farmers and the work that women are doing in agriculture as activists and as protectors. Here in the western Upper Peninsula, so about 9 hours northeast of you, I've been involved with the start of the Western UP Food Systems Council. So when I moved here, people asked what I was going to study now because I'm in the Western UP and there's food at Walmart or Econo, but there's no agriculture here, people told me. But that's really not true. The Great Lakes region is a region of food abundance since time immemorial. There's been fish and food in the forests and hunting and agricultural crops. I'm very lucky to have the Keweenaw Indian community 40 minutes south of here and to be collaborating with folks at their Natural Resource Department on food sovereignty initiatives in the Western UP region, to be working with local farmers and beginning farmers here. The season is short, but the land is a lot cheaper than what we're used to in Iowa. And there are a lot of small market farms and CSAs, young people moving back to have access to land and to have a good quality of life and to live in a place where you can hike in the woods and let your dog swim in the waters. It's very nice. As much as I miss home and Iowa, I'm very grateful for the long history of care and work that's been done here to try to protect the Great Lakes region. So I'm very involved with the Western UP Food Systems Council, and I'm teaching classes on food systems and sustainability here at Michigan Tech. It's a little different student set than at Iowa State. The students come here because they want to be engineers or work in computer science or be foresters, right? But there's a lot of interest in sustainability and health and awareness that to have a more sustainable food system, we need a lot of different types of knowledge because what we have been doing has not been working for most people. So I've been very impressed by the students' interest in trying to improve food accessibility even on our campus and proposing changes about our local food pantry, creating more opportunities for community meals and meal sharing in our community. As you both know, it's just so fun to do work in food because food brings people together. Everybody has something to say about it. Everybody has a favorite food. So whether you grow food or not, there's something that people have to say when you have a meeting or bring people together about food.
Angie, this is really exciting work that you're doing and continue to do. And I think you've made a really important point as well, is that women can make a difference in agriculture, particularly when they work together. So by forming groups of men and women and having these groups discuss what's going on, discuss what's working and how to make it work better, is a really important aspect of the work that you're doing.
We did not intend it to be this way, but I was not surprised, having studied women in agriculture for a long time, but all the folks who are bringing together different communities in the Western UP Food Systems Council, the lead team of us, we're not an elected council or anything. We're just an ad hoc, more grassroots planning team. But all the members of that team are women. We didn't intend it to be that way. That's just who stepped up. But I think that often, because women still do a disproportionate amount of taking care of children and making meals at home and doing the grocery shopping and things, that these questions about food and health are maybe more central to thinking to what the work that women are already doing. I also think that because this work, like you were sharing, Cornelia, the work in food that ends up making lots of money ends up being controlled often by men, and then the work that is smaller scale or seen as not as profitable is feminized. And so there may be barriers for men who are very interested in sustainability, but maybe it's not seen as like the masculine way of farming, right? It's not the right way to farm, or that they may have barriers too in trying to enter conversations about more localized food systems or sustainability. And so thinking of ways that we can help teach people that this type of agriculture is healthier, not just for our lands and waters, but for all people, and that it benefits all types of farmers, is really important.
This is excellent. Angie, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's an hour later there in Michigan, and you have to go teach a class. But again, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Well, thank you, Gina and Neil, and what a pleasure to get to phone into KHOI, my favorite community radio station. So hello to all of you in Ames. Hope you have a good day.
Thank you, Angie.
Bye.
Okay, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts for this hour, Cornelia Flora.
And Gina McAndrews.
Thank you for listening in. Our next guest is Anna Johnson, Policy Manager for the Center of Rural Affairs. Her office is in Nevada, but she lives in Ames. Angie, what do you see as major issues facing women in agriculture these days?
Well, first, good morning, Neil. Good morning, Gina. It's really good to be here. I want to make sure you all can hear me okay. Yes, so maybe I can start off just by talking a little bit about our work at the Center for Rural Affairs, because I know that folks in Ames might not be as familiar with it. So we were founded in Nebraska over 45 years ago by a group of folks who were looking at some of the challenges that farmers in rural communities were facing. And we were founded to kind of stand up for and work with folks in rural communities on several fronts. And so currently our work today encompasses a couple different areas. Two of them are kind of on the ground direct assistance that we do primarily in Nebraska. So that's small business lending, because we know that a big driver of economic opportunity in rural communities is access to employment and access to economic opportunity, and small businesses creating opportunity for entrepreneurs to create and build their small businesses is a really important pathway. So we have a lot of we provide small business loans to those folks, and then we also have some various training and community inclusion work that we do in Nebraska. We have beginning farmer trainings. We work with Latino farmers in Nebraska, and whole variety of different programming there. When we were originally founded, the original group of folks who were looking at the challenges that rural communities were facing realized that there's also a need to get involved in policy work. And so for 45 years, we've been involved in agricultural policy. And so my work is in that space. I work on agricultural policy for the Center for Rural Affairs, and we do, I work on farm bill stuff. And so, the question about, what are the challenges that are specific to women in agriculture? I think we just heard from the wonderful Angie Carter up in Michigan. She and I actually both serve on the board of the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network, and that's the main way that I am involved in kind of the women in ag space. And as Angie shared with us, there's several different ways that women are currently involved in agriculture and support,
food and agriculture, yeah, and just life in general.
Exactly. So Angie talked a lot about some of her work with women landowners and helping women landowners get access to, conservation information. But I also thought I might talk a little bit about some of the other programming that the Women, Food, and Ag Network does.
That would be great.
Yeah. The Women, Food, and Ag Network, also founded in Iowa. One of the other programs that we have is to work with women who are trying to get into farming, because one of the things that I like to, when I'm talking about WFAN, I like to pull up a website and Google the word farmer and demonstrate what are the images that come up. And if you try this, you'll see that 9 out of 10 of the images that will come up are men, and which just shows that there's still this perception that, like, a farmer means, for many people means a man. And so for women who want to get into farming, this can be kind of like one of the many barriers to overcome. And so we have a program where we match women who are interested in, maybe interested in farming. We match them with women farmer mentors, because we also have seen that having a mentor relationship is really important for farmers' success.
So I help them build some confidence and knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the amount of skill that goes into running a successful farm is wild. There's not only the crop production pieces of managing with the risks that come with weather and learning all the different agronomic pieces of cultivation, and then there's also business management and financial management and marketing.
Price.
and fixing your machinery when it breaks down, and which of those, of those skills that you maybe don't have yourself, finding out who you can lean on. Beginning Women Farmer programming is aimed at helping those folks get access to some of that information and training that they might is helpful to them. So, and then a third major area that the Women, Food, and Ag Network has had programming in, kind of the more policy arena. And so what we have done there is the program's called Plate to Politics, and we host trainings for women who are having that realization that policy and politics have a huge impact on our food system, food and agriculture system, and who are interested in getting involved. And so these are workshops that we hold to help women kind of build some of the skills needed to run for office. So we've had these trainings all over, held all over the country, mm-hmm, at this point, which is very cool. And they're really valuable opportunities for folks who are able to attend to learn more about kind of some of those skills around, like, how do you give your stump speech? How do you build a network? How do you fundraise for a pillow campaign? It's really nuts and bolts kinds of training. So those are some of the areas that we've been involved in trying to get more space for women and ag. And then also Angie mentioned, but for those who've tuned in more recently, if anybody's interested in kind of learning more and getting involved in this and, you know, in this work, we're having the Women in Sustainable Ag conference this weekend, Thursday through Saturday, up in St. Paul, Minnesota, and they're going to be walk-in registrations for anybody who's able to take the day off and go on up. So,
and what will be some of the topics that might be covered there?
Yeah, so I don't have the agenda up in front of me, but I think there's going to be a whole bunch of different several different workshops covering a variety of things. Usually at these sorts of conferences, there's a couple workshops on specific types of production, you know, like, you know, maybe some questions for vegetable folks or folks having with birds or livestock. But then also there's questions about, there's going to be some of those big picture questions, right? Because, you know, I think there's going to be probably going to touch somewhat on climate change and then issues, and other issues that agriculture is facing. So.
That's great. How about with the Center for Rural Affairs? What types of policy and what activities are you working on there for Iowa?
Yes, great question. So, in my professional role for working at the Center for Rural Affairs, our policy portfolio is pretty broad. I work on, as I mentioned, I work on farm bill policy, and in that space, I focus a lot on our conservation policy. So that's the and so that's for those wonks following along at home with your farm bill in front of you. This is Title II of the farm bill. Mm-hmm. These are the programs that help farmers and these are programs that help farmers access support for increasing the amount of conservation that they're doing on their land. And so we are most focused on programs that are called working lands programs. So this is the idea that farmers and ranchers can be doing production and conservation on their land. And so these are programs like one of the major ones that we work in is called the Conservation Stewardship Program. And this is a program that helps farmers and ranchers who are already doing some level of conservation to kind of take a comprehensive approach to their operation and say, okay, so we're doing this, you know, maybe we're planting cover crops here and we've got a buffer strip here, but we'd like to, you know, increase our level of conservation by adding on some advanced grazing management practices or some other pieces. And so what they do is they go into their local Natural Resource Conservation Service office, we all have one. No matter where you're listening from in the country, you have a local Natural Resource Conservation Office or NRCS office. And so you go in there and you speak with the staff there and tell them about your operation and what you're trying to do, and then you can work with them to apply to enroll in these programs. So right now we're almost at the end of the first year of the most recent farm bill having been passed. And so another thing that we're working on is the U.S. Department of Agriculture is charged right now with implementing the farm bill, which was, you know, passed last December. And so that, you know, one might look at the farm bill as a big to-do list for USDA of all the different ways they need to change their programs and new policies to implement. So in the conservation space, we're watching for USDA to release the updates to their conservation programs, and which we're hoping they're going to be able to do in the next couple months. So that's a big thing we're working on.
Well, this is really important, and one of the problems is USDA is busy moving people around, and so a lot of things are coming out very late. And I don't know and we certainly notice this as a social scientist who works a lot with agricultural data. That data is not coming through now that they've sort of dismantled the Economic Research Service. What about some of the implementation of some of these programs? Is that been affected by attrition in jobs at USDA, or is it moving forward at a normal pace?
That's a really good point, Neil. So it's The programs I was just talking about, the conservation programs, those have not really been affected by the relocation that you were talking about, because they're managed by the branch, by the Natural Resource Conservation Service, NRCS. It sounds like you're referencing the relocation of the Economic Research Service and the National Institute for Food and Agriculture, ERS and NIFA, which are both smaller agencies that have historically been based in D.C. The Economic Research Service is charged with doing like what its name says it does, doing economic research on agriculture. And then NIFA, the National Institute for Food and Agriculture, has a variety of different responsibilities, but one of those is administering of a wide variety of grant programs for farmers, for other groups who are supporting farmers, and for those who've been following the story, the current administration has proposed to move those agencies out to. Away from D.C., and my understanding is that relocation has been moving forward, and there have been a lot of staff who've been lost. And I think one of the things that we'll be watching is particularly with the grant programs that NIFA administers. Those are, we're watching to see if loss of staff is going to impact USDA's ability to administer those programs. One of those programs that we pay attention to pay particularly close attention to is the Beginning Farmer Rancher Development Program, which is a program that provides grants to organizations who are doing kind of education and training for beginning farmers and ranchers across the country. And this has been a really successful program and provided some really valuable support to a lot of beginning farmers across the country. It's the grants are awarded on an annual basis. I think applications were due this past summer. We're kind of watching and waiting to see what the impact will be. But certainly we're watching and concerned about it.
So what do you see as the upcoming issues that you'll be working on this year?
Oh, golly, Gina. So many things. We stay busy. Well, I think one thing that I also want to make sure to say is that we were concerned about the comments that Secretary Perdue made recently about kind of the consolidation of agriculture as being somewhat inevitable. And that's kind of part of the kind of DNA of the Center for Rural Affairs is around is that the policies that are passed are choices that that people make, and if those policies if the result of those policies is greater consolidation, that is a choice and it's not inevitability, and so there are a couple of spaces that we're always that there's several different areas where policy can be changed in order to kind of be addressing the ongoing consolidation in agriculture. In the next year, I'm not sure that I can like list for you what the definite ones we're going to be working on in the next year are. We're still kind of figuring that out, but that is certainly an area that we're always always eager to work in, and are always interested in hearing folks' thoughts on. I guess, kind of on our to-do list, in addition to kind of that broad broad effort to be highlighting ongoing consolidation in agriculture, we also have some kind of smaller ongoing projects. In addition to the conservation programs work that I mentioned earlier, I'm also doing some work around crop insurance. Why do we work on crop insurance? We like the Center for Rural Affairs. We support rural communities. Part of rural communities in the Midwest is healthy family farms. Part of healthy family farms is economic stability. And then part of that is part of economic stability is having access to strong risk management options. So we have a really robust crop insurance system here in the Midwest for our kind of major commodity production of corn and beans, but for folks who are producing, for folks who are endeavoring to kind of build alternative businesses outside of that kind of dominant structure, with more diversified crops, with fruits or vegetables, with more small grains. Sometimes crop insurance doesn't always. The crop insurance options aren't always made to support those alternative kinds of businesses, and so we're trying to do some outreach and education around some of the crop insurance options that exist. So,
this is very interesting because insurance of any kind really means shared risk.
Yes.
And why do we want to share risk? For example, in health insurance, we share risks because we think everyone should be healthy. We know we're all better off if people can maintain their health and live longer. And with crop insurance, where we as taxpayers also participate, is because we know that we're all better off if we have a healthy, diverse food supply. So it becomes easy to insure the dominant crops, which are wheat, cotton, corn, and soybeans. It's a lot harder when you don't have all those records on the thousands of other crops we could grow that would diversify our diets and also be able to allow for more flexibility, better soil health, etc. So working on the issues of what crops are insured, what are the parameters around that insurance, are very, very important.
Yes, thank you.
And frankly, this is where we need the Economic Research Service that can help explain to us how do we get the records to say what is a reasonable degree of risk. And as you know, when risk is high, rates go up. If you build in the floodplain, your flood insurance is going to cost a lot more than if you're on a hillside. So how do we share the risk in a way that does not encourage risky behavior? And frankly, my mother-in-law farmed out in western Kansas with her husband, and he was saying, oh, we've got to hurry and plant the wheat. And I said, Billy, there's a drought. Why are you planting the wheat now? Because it won't germinate, because there's no water. He said, oh, well, the crop insurance won't. If we're going to be covered by crop insurance, we have to plant it now. So you have rules often that are designed for a homogeneous situation when, in fact, nothing is more local than agriculture. So the notion of how do we get good crop insurance programs so, one, we can help reduce the risk, but secondly, how do we do it in a way that doesn't encourage risky behavior? Which I would say is planting by a certain date, even though the soil is soaked or is incredibly dry.
Absolutely. And I think you bring up a good point there about crop insurance that is another area that we've worked on in the past and we're interested in kind of continuing to lift up, which is that many conservation practices can actually help reduce risk. You know, if you're using agronomic practices that are building soil health, and the soil's capacity to hang on to water, that then increases your crop's resilience to drought and to heavy water events. And so, how can we make sure that our farm programs and our crop insurance programs are encouraging greater conservation? And how can we kind of what are the pieces that need to be put into place in order to kind of demonstrate on a really broad scale that doing these conservation practices is going to be actually decreasing risk, and therefore, you know, we should be rewarded on our crop insurance for doing them. So,
do we know of any other states who have any crop insurance, vegetable insurance for smaller farms? And
that is a great question, Gina. So I'm going to get a little, I do a policy job. I just get wonky all day. This is what I do. So Crop insurance is administered by USDA also. USDA has many different agencies that do a lot of different things. And they set crop insurance policy for, you know, for the country. Then there are about 15 or 16 large private companies that have partnerships with USDA, and they manage they sell the crop insurance policies. And so there's a public-private partnership there. And so they're supposed to offer, insurance across the whole country. And it does vary by region and by state. So in California, there's a lot more insurance for fruit and vegetable crops, whereas in Iowa, it's, there aren't as many fruit and vegetable farmers, and so there aren't as many, apple policies available here in Iowa because we don't grow that many apples. However, to the points that we were talking about, if we want to see more diversified farms out on the landscape, having crop insurance that supports them is important. And so in the 2014 Farm Bill, they created a pilot program called the Whole Farm Revenue Protection, which is supposed to help those farms. It offers a crop insurance option for those farms by, instead of insuring all of their individual crops and livestock, it will insure the revenue for the whole operation, and all the things that encompasses. So that program is available in every state, in every county, because it's a federal crop insurance option. So if you're interested in looking into insurance options, for more diversified production, that's the thing to be looking at right now. And feel free to follow up with me. If folks are listening here or want to hear more about it, I don't want to go too deep in the weeds on it, but please feel free to reach out.
I think this is really important, that are we insuring a crop? Are we insuring a farm? What is it that we're, are we a piece of land? These are all different sort of concepts, and they all come together, but they do it in different ways. So I think particularly when we have so much of the land is not owned by the people who are doing the farming, this gets very, very complicated in terms of who's the person who is actually doing the farm work compared to the person who is actually owning the land. And I had a very interesting study at the Royal Sociological Society meetings where they were trying to look at land ownership. This was in Indiana, not Iowa, but it was very, very difficult because you had these limited liability corporations that were bought up by yet other firms and other firms. So you had these very stacked ownership patterns. So it was difficult to say who owns the land and then who gets the insurance payment, who gets the buyouts or the money that comes from the tariff stuff. And it's very, these are complicated patterns. It's very different from our sort of frontier version of what farming looked like. And so understanding, this sounds really boring, the structure of agriculture is really important for us, and how women fit into that in terms of how they feel about the land. It used to be, when we did surveys, we would ask people, are you planning to, is somebody going to succeed you on the land? Is someone from your family going to take over the land? And that was very important as recently as 30 years ago. Now this is more like, this is my my farm is my retirement account. I'm going to sell it. So the notion of what is your time horizon for your farm is shifting. So I'm wondering, are we finding, and I should have asked Angie Carter this as well, are we finding, and she kind of mentioned this, that women have more sort of a long-term view of their land?
Yeah, that's a good question, Neil, and I'm not sure that I really know the answer to that. I know that that one of the statistics that the Women, Food, and Ag Network works to lift up is in kind of landowner surveys of landowners in Iowa, they found that 50% of the land is either owned or co-owned by women, and so it's important to, and that's a lot of people. That's a lot of land. And I think also, and so this is, and I will speak a little bit to this, but I'll first give the caveat that it's not my area of work at the Center for Rural Affairs. Some of my colleagues at the Center for Rural Affairs have been actually collaborating with the Women Food Network, Ag Network, to work with women landowners. And while for several years we were working with women landowners who lived in rural areas, we've now expanded that to also be working with women who are, and not the term is non-operator landowners, so women who are maybe living in the city, and it's a and there's family land that they've inherited, but or maybe they lived on it when they were younger, but they don't live there now. And how do we, and you know, and so if they're not in a rural community, if they're not in an agricultural setting, how do they get access to information about conservation and thinking about and you know and you know, raising for them the issues about like the health of the land and how to be increasing conservation on it, and you know, and also just speaking to their values, you know, like what does the land mean to them, and what would they like to see happen to it. So
one of the interesting things I saw Women, Food and Agriculture Network doing was working with these landowners, women landowners, to say, how do you write a contract with your renter or farm management company that includes these conservation goals? Because the person who's farming it may not have, I mean, they care about the land, certainly, but their goals are going to be, how do I get over the most land the quickest? Which all these conservation things put barriers to your tractor. So how is it you can write a contract that is agreeable to the person on the ground doing the work, but is also meets conservation goals? And that is not so easy, but it's very important.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's some of the work that our wonderful staff has been doing. And I, you know, don't want to speak too much to it in detail because I'm not sure I can give a particularly informed response. But it is really important to kind of make sure that, you know, particularly in rental situations, that there's a clear understanding about.
What are they finding are the best ways to actually, you know, contact the owners and get them involved in learning, especially the women, about these different practices? And
that is a great question, Gina. There's several different ways to answer it. I know that we've kind of developed outreach materials that are for women landowners, specifically. And then when we'd go and do when WFAN staff go and do workshops in rural communities, I know that they kind of, it's an all channel reach out. They you know, talk to the local radio stations. I think they put announcements in local newspapers. There's Facebook. They will do mailings, just trying to like get the word out, because we're all really busy these days, and getting on folks' calendars can be a challenge.
Is there like a website for Women, Food and Agriculture where, you know, people can go and find or get involved in that sort of growing food and finding out more about getting into agriculture?
Absolutely. So the Women, Food and Ag Network, our website is WFAN.org, and that has information about our upcoming workshops as well as information about the conference I mentioned in St. Paul that's starting tomorrow and runs through Saturday, St. Paul, Minnesota. And then, as I mentioned, I work at the Center for Rural Affairs, and our organization is CFRA.org. You can find our stuff there. Yeah, those are both really great places to start to kind of just dig in and see some of the work that we're doing, as well as kind of look at some of the partners that we work with, and kind of just figure out who the folks are in your area who you might want to connect with. So.
And with your trainings and things, have you seen a lot of women getting involved in the policy and running for office? That sort of.
Yeah, I didn't pull up my notes on the stats of how Plate to Politics has been doing, but I know that they've, you know, the number of workshops that we've held has been really exciting, and we're gonna have a Plate to Politics. That's our training women to run for office program. We're gonna have that as a piece of the conference that's happening this weekend. It's very exciting.
I love that name, Plate to Politics.
Yeah, it's great.
And so what's your future goals? Are you staying involved in agriculture? And what kind of kept you in food and agriculture?
That's a great question, Gina. I guess my story is a little bit maybe unusual but, you know, we all have unusual stories. I am actually from Maryland originally, and I started learning about agriculture when I was in college, and I was really intrigued by kind of several different facets of it, and so I was able to work on a couple of small vegetable farms on the East Coast, and then I was able to actually work at the U.S. Department of Agriculture for a couple of years in Washington, D.C., and then I kind of looked around and said, man, you know, if I want to learn more about agriculture in this country, I should probably, you know, move somewhere where it's a more dominant part of life. And I applied to several graduate schools, and Iowa State seemed like the right fit. And so I moved out here, and that was 5 years ago, and here we are. So,
were you surprised when you got here that there wasn't very many fruit and vegetable farms?
No, not at all. I had done my research. But yeah.
But good. You're going to work to get there more.
Well, you know, we want to have diversified operations of the landscape, but the thing about fruit and vegetable farms is that they're really labor intensive, and so there are certain areas of the world where you know there are more fruit and vegetable farms, and it's kind of like the structure of ag in those places is different. So there's kind of having access to processing facilities is really important for those folks, as well as access to labor, and that's a whole other issue that
And there was a processing place in Nevada with Penny Brown Huber that was started, and then the tornadoes, there were issues.
Oh, no. Oh.
And I'm not sure if that got rebuilt or not.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that. With
the status. I'll check on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's some out in western Kansas, too, where small-scale vegetable producers are at least agglomerating, having good marketing systems, because it's one thing to grow it. And I think that you make the point, these are many, many skills involved in agriculture. It's a very complex procedure. And then if you've also got to learn about marketing and value chain, so it's very much more, it's not easy, but it's easier to fit into doing what everybody else does around you, because those paths are there and you can do them. Mm-hmm. We call that sort of, we have a lot of path-determined structures in place. So to break out of that path, do something different, whether you're driven by policy, by concern for the land, by changes in the climate, all of these things means it's a whole lot. You've made something that is already complex in the system, so that we can't have straight causality, we now make it even more complicated. So it's really important that people are getting together, discussing it, figuring out how do we put in just small ways to make that happen. So, Angie, I really appreciate Angie. Anna. Too many A's today.
It's true.
Anna and Angie, we appreciate both of you with your really wide experience in looking at women in agriculture, but linking it to the larger systems in which they're embedded, to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And I hope people can get to that conference this weekend
up
in St. Paul.
Okay. You have been listening to Local Talk at KHOI Community Radio. The Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz, and Cornelia Flora, me, and Gina McAndrews have been your hosts. Thank you for listening. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a training program in radio production and everyday people who are learning to be street reporters. If you're interested, we'll train you, and you can have an input here.
Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m.
You can also hear a copy of the show on our homepage at khoifm.org.
Please remember that your participation and support as audience is what makes Local Talk and KHOI possible.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.